This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bulgave in for Terry Gross. Let's get this straight right now. Cameron Manheim is not plus-sized or robust or generously proportioned. She's fat, and she's not afraid to say it. Manheim has appeared in the films Happiness and Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, but she's best known for her role as Eleanor Fruit, the forceful yet sensitive attorney on the ABC legal drama The Practice. Here's a scene from the episode in which Eleanor finds out what another partner in the firm, Lindsay, is earning. She's outraged and tries to make another lawyer in the practice, Eugene, an ally.
$242,000?
Am I overreacting? I mean, I know she brings in business, but to be making twice what we do?
Well, the partnership agreement is pretty clear. The formula is...
Yes, the formula favors who brings in the business. But when we vote on new business, and Lindsay getting one vote and Bobby getting two, plus the tiebreaker, with only three other voting partners, the two of them control...
Eleanor.
They sleep together, Eugene. Who are we kidding? She makes twice what we make.
You forget that we became partners because of her power play. It went to our benefit.
You're forgetting that it was a power play. Look at these numbers. Numbers are numbers. They are not subject to interpretation.
Manheim has a new book about her struggle with fat, her outspokenness, the acting business, and self-acceptance. It's called Wake Up, I'm Fat. It's based on her one-woman show. She says that ever since she was a kid, she would talk to her fat as if it were a real person, and it was always a man.
Every time I would have these conversations in my head, I would literally speak out loud. I'd go, you know, why? Why do you follow me around? Why are you here? Why did you pick me? And then in my head, I would hear this male voice going, I didn't pick you, you picked me. And I would have these huge arguments in my room. I'd scream and cry. It was really fascinating to me as a kid, but I thought everybody had them, you know? But the voice was male. And as I grew up and was able to, you know, have better insight to that, I realized it's because the pain that I suffered at the hand of this voice, its tyranny was quintessentially male. I just don't know any women who would ever, you know, make me suffer like that. So I don't have that, you know, those conversations much anymore because I feel that I'm very much in control of it. But as a kid, I was overwhelmed by voices, you know, beating myself up about my weight.
You describe your parents as liberal activists. Were they progressive when it came to your weight?
Well, you know, it's so funny. My parents are fantastic. I talk about in my book how I grew up with these liberal lefties, you know, and there's even a section where I say I got thrown in jail once. I was protesting at a pro-choice rally, and, you know, they just threw a bunch of us in jail as a statement. And I called my mom from jail, and I said, Mom, I'm in jail. And she said, oh, my God, what for? And I said, well, I got arrested for participating in a pro-choice rally. And this is what she said. She went, oh, my God, honey, mazel tov. That's wonderful. And you could hear her screaming to my father, going, Jerry, Cameron got arrested for civil disobedience. My dad on the other end going, that's great, honey. Go, go, go. Fight, fight, fight. And I'm like, Mom, I'm in jail. Help me get out. And she's like, no, honey, you stay in there and you make your point. So I grew up with that. You know, my parents were always protesting some nuclear site or bringing medical supplies to Cuba. Or we have so many photographs of them carrying picket signs. It's really quite a lovely legacy to have. But I suppose the one thing that always puzzled me as a kid, as my parents were fighting for the underdogs all their life, they never really saw me as an underdog. And I needed so much to have somebody fight for me.
Well, so, what tack did your parents take? Did they try to pressure you outright to lose weight, or did they go the more indirect route, like keeping your portion small and hoping you didn't notice it or something?
Wow, that's funny. My mom and dad did everything they could think of, you know. First of all, in defense of them, I just want to say that there wasn't as much insight back then to child rearing as there is now. There wasn't as much focus on it. So my parents were doing what they thought was best, but inadvertently, you know, really screwed me up. Not that I blame them now, but my parents bribed me all the time. They would actually have me sign contracts. Like, if you lose 15 pounds by March, we'll get you a new bike. And, you know, I was learning the value of a contract and what it meant to keep a contract, and I would sign it, you know, but I never really did anything. It just, the contract itself was kind of exciting. But when you're, you know, 11, it doesn't, you know, losing weight and your self-image and how you fit on the planet doesn't make any sense. You're just doing it to please somebody else because you don't get it. It's very hard with children. And my mom took me to psychologists and to hypnotists. Everyone was struggling to try to figure out, you know, I think they blamed themselves. I know my mom blamed herself, you know, that she hadn't taken care of me better or, you know, made me gain all this weight. Because I was a skinny kid, so I think everyone was a little freaked out that I had gained a lot of weight. But I really attribute it to the fact that I moved to Southern California when I was 11. That, to me, is where it all began. You know, I had come from the Midwest where literally they don't even sell bikinis in the Midwest. It's just one piece, and some of them are turtlenecks. You know, nobody shows their bodies in the Midwest. It's not, no flesh here. And I got off the boat in Southern California, and people were walking around in bikinis. And then I'd go to the grocery store, and they'd be shopping for food in bikinis. And my instincts told me that, you know, shopping for double stuffed Oreos in a bikini was a no-no. So I got fat, and I think it was some really deep subconscious way of never having to put on one of those bathing suits and do that. And I think that, coupled with a whole bunch of other things, you know, helped me put on the weight. But I don't even care about that anymore. I don't want to go back and relive it and whose fault it is. I really just want to take what I have and do as much good with it as I can.
You decided pretty early on you wanted to be an actress. Where'd the idea come from?
You know, that's really funny. I was at camp. I was at a commune. My parents were on a sabbatical, and I was at a commune. And I remember really vividly, I was sitting under a big orchard tree and having a popsicle, and a counselor came up to me and said, "Do you want to be in a play?" And I said, okay. And I went with her, and I didn't realize that you had to do it more than once. I just thought, you know, you do it the one time and that was it. It didn't occur to me that I was making a pact with them to spend the rest of my summer vacation doing a play. But I did this play, and people clapped for me and came up to me afterwards and told me how great I was. And that was the most seductive drug I have ever encountered, and I never looked back.
When you're on stage, do you have a different relationship to your fat? A different consciousness of your body?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. I know this, that when I was in acting school, I had no sense of my body, and I acted from my neck up. And all my teachers said, you know, you carry all your tension in your neck. You act with your face. You never include your body when you're acting. And it took me many years to actually incorporate my body into my acting because I just, like I said, wanted to disappear, make it go away. And I think I also felt that if I used all my force from my body and my breath, that I would, you know, I'd yell at somebody and they'd, you know, go through the wall. So what would happen is I'd end up being in an argument, and instead of really, you know, screaming at somebody and telling them how angry I was, I'd end up going, "I'm so mad at you, I can't believe it." And I would lose my voice, and I refused to let any energy come from me because I think I was afraid of my power. And when I finally found my power, I embraced it, and, you know, there's no stopping me.
You started doing speed in graduate school. Did you consider it a diet aid?
Yeah, I never considered, you know, when I was taking speed, and I took it because I had I knew a friend who dealt it. And one summer I was at her house, and this woman came in to get some, and I was really, you know, intrigued by the whole thing because I had never done it. And I happened to be back at that same woman's house about 4 months later when the woman came back to get more speed, and she had literally lost about 70 pounds. It was phenomenal. And I always had remembered that. And when I started to get more and more pressure from the industry and from my school and from my parents and from my lovers to be thinner, I always kept in the back of my mind that I could go back to my girlfriend and ask her for some of that stuff. And I did. And when I took it, it was entirely as a diuretic and not in any way to, you know, get, you know, high. So In fact, I don't really remember ever feeling particularly high, just that I didn't want to eat. And I lost so much weight so quickly. And nobody ever, you know, inquired how I did that. No one ever seemed to be very concerned. You know, you'd think if someone lost a lot of weight who had had a lot of trouble with it earlier, one might say, are you okay? Are you doing this, you know, in a healthy fashion? We're just interested and curious about you. But I never, you know, it was me again, just trying to hide and disappear and make sure nobody knew what was going on. And even my friends now who read my book or I tell the story to say, I never knew. I never knew. So, yeah.
What made you stop?
That's a great question. I was lying on my bed one day. I have a 22-pound cat, Steve. And Steve likes to sleep on my chest. And he and every morning I push him off because I can't breathe. And one morning I woke up and I couldn't breathe. And I pushed Steve off, only he wasn't there. And I realized that I couldn't breathe anymore, you know. So that was one of the reasons why I quit smoking. And ultimately, the reason why I quit speed is because I had a near-fatal overdose. I did too much, and I landed in the hospital, and I knew that it was, you know, it was D-Day. My body wasn't going to have any more of it. My heart couldn't take it anymore, and I mean that in every sense of the word. So I quit smoking and I quit doing speed. And I obviously rapidly put the weight back on because, you know, smoking and the speed, that combination was just so, my metabolism was so screwed up. And I put the weight back on very quickly, but this time I was in therapy and really trying to work it out. And I was devoted to finding a healthy place for me to live, and, you know, mind, body, and soul. And you can't do that when you're on speed.
Cameron Manheim's book is Wake Up, I'm Fat. She won an Emmy last year for her performance as Eleanor on the ABC drama The Practice. More after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with actress Cameron Manheim. She plays Eleanor on ABC's The Practice. After you finished your postgrad work, you were out there auditioning. What were you generally offered in the way of parts? Were you the big-breasted gal with the heart of gold?
No, I never even got close to the big-breasted gal with the heart of gold. That would have been good, because that's so true. No, you know, people have this unbelievable perception of fat women, and usually they're very self-loathing and self-deprecating, and my experience is they usually have, like, an upper respiratory problem and are wheezing, you know, okay, you know, and they've got lots of Kleenex. There's not a very nice view of fat women out there. You certainly never see, you know, big, beautiful, sensual, sophisticated, articulate women, you know, laid out in scripts. So when I was just starting, I was going up for prison wardens, for nurses, you know, for the Swedish masseuse, you know, who's like pounding on your back, and you're like, and you're like, no, stop it, I'm doing your back, you know, it's like, like these horrible, you know, stereotypes. And one time I got a script that said, the description of the character was, we're looking, you know, Susan, a morbidly obese woman of 200 pounds. And I thought, wow, this is so screwed up because I weigh over 200 pounds and I don't think of myself as morbidly obese. So I walk into this audition and I, you know, do my thing. And they said, you know, you're very talented and we like you very much, but you're not big enough for her.
You're not fat enough.
You're not fat enough. You are not grossly overweight over 200 pounds. And that's when I said, I just want to say that you've got this all wrong because I weigh a lot more than 200 pounds. And if I'm not fat enough, you have to rework your description here. And I think that they were all, you know, shocked that I was over 200 pounds and I didn't need a walker to come into the room. So I started asking my agents to be more creative with me, to not set me up for the fat girl roles, mostly because I wasn't the fat girl they were looking for. They wanted that pathetic girl, yeah?
You had an interesting strategy to buck the stereotype. You started auditioning for male parts.
That's right.
How does that work? Are you allowed to go on a call for a male part?
Well, if you have an agent who is willing to stick their neck out for you and is willing to run that extra mile, they basically have to call the casting person and say, I understand you have a call for a male lawyer. Would you consider seeing a woman? And some of them will, you know, be closed-minded and go, no. And some might say, well, who do you have in mind? And if that casting person knows their theater, they would have known about me because I was kicking around in the theater for about 10 years. And, you know, my agent might say, well, you know what? I was thinking about Cameron Manheim. I think she could be a ballsy attorney who can command the room. And maybe 1 out of 10 times a casting director would say, you know what? Let's do it. We'll just put her name on the list and we'll bring her in. I won't even ask.
What part did you originally audition for in the practice?
I originally auditioned for Eleanor, but, you know, David Kelly wasn't that interested in me. He had somebody else entirely in mind. And I don't think David, when he saw my... We sent him a tape of a couple of the things that I had done in the past. One of them being a lawyer that was originally supposed to be a man and turned out to be me. And I don't think he was really impressed by my tape.
You did get an audition, though, with David Kelly, the creator right. and the executive producer of The Practice. Did you hit it off with him right away?
Well, like I said, he was not that impressed with the tape that we sent him. He had actually expressed to the casting director that he felt that I was too conservative. And the casting director said, okay, you've got this girl wrong. She's acting on those tapes as a conservative lawyer. But, you know, she's got 12 holes in her ear. She's got a tattoo. She rides a motorcycle. She is not conservative. And I think, you know, David, just out of respect for his casting director, said, all right, fine, I'll meet her. So I get in there, and David Kelly is an extraordinary man, and I'm not just saying that because he's my boss. First of all, he looks 12, and that will throw anybody off right away, you know. To me, he was Mr. Michelle Pfeiffer, because, frankly, I didn't really know who David Kelly was. All I knew is he was married to the most beautiful woman in the world, and I thought, well, he must be special in some way. And not only is he 12, but he can be very shy, and we had this very awkward interview, and I knew right then that I was never going to work on a David Kelly show. I knew it, but that was going to be the end of it. So I was literally halfway out of my chair, ready to leave, when I noticed that he had a cribbage board sitting next to his table. And I just said, David, do you play cribbage? And he looked at me and he said, I don't think you want to go there with me. Now, I don't know about you, but I am a tournament bridge player and a very major competitor. And my father was a mathematician, so the one thing you don't want to challenge me to is a game of cards. And he turned to me and he said, I don't think you understand. I play the computer. And I said, I don't think you understand. I play for money. And I said, why don't we just screw this audition right now and I'll play you right now for the part. And he hemmed and hawed a little bit and he said, I think you have a better chance getting the part if you actually audition. And that's when I said, you know what? I can smell your fear. So if you want to play, I'll play you for the part. If not, we all know who's the fraidy cat. And he laughed, and I knew that I had made some inroads because it was a far cry from the nap he was taking earlier during our other part of the interview. But I got a script, and the description of the character said, big ballsy woman walks in. And I knew right then that I had made some kind of impact on Mr. Michelle Pfeiffer.
Actress Cameron Manheim. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Cameron Manheim. When we left off, she was telling us about how she got the role of lawyer Eleanor Frutt on the ABC program The Practice. So you landed the part, and you write that on the first day on the set of The Practice, your first scene called for you to walk to work with Bobby, the head of the firm played by Dylan
right.
McDermott, and you were supposed to eat a donut on the way to work. So how did that sit with you?
Well, you know, it's my first day. They've got this big Hollywood director directing the pilot. You know, he's a big deal. And I've never been, you know, I've been on a couple TV shows as a guest, but never as a principal. And I wasn't really quite sure of the rules about how soon into the, you know, project they could fire me. You know, I wasn't sure how the contract read. And it's the first scene. It's not only the first scene of my shooting, but it is actually the first scene of the pilot, where Bobby and Eleanor are walking very briskly through the courtyard up to the courthouse. So it's an establishing shot of these two characters and an establishing shot of the city we're in. It's a very important shot. And the prop guy comes over and hands me a cup of coffee and a donut. And I'm like, well, what are these for? He goes, they're your props. And I was mortified. I was so embarrassed. I didn't know what to do. And I walked up to the director and I, in my pretend being very cordial voice, because I was pissed. And I said, listen, I don't know if it's such a good idea for me to have a donut, to introduce the character with a donut. And he said, look, you don't have to eat it. I just want to give that we're rushing to work kind of feeling. And, with the donut and the coffee and all the files, it just looks like you didn't have time for breakfast. And he made this plea, and I didn't know what to do. I knew I couldn't really argue it because I wasn't sure if I could get fired. So my mind was racing a mile a minute, and I walked over to Dylan, and I didn't really tell him what my motive was, but I just said, Dylan, don't you think my character would be like your right-hand woman? Because we were still trying to define who our characters were because we didn't know. I think that I'd be holding all your files. I think I'd be holding your coffee and your donut, and I'd just have everything. And that, you'd just be talking, and I'll be there holding everything for you. And he went, that's great. And I said, in fact, maybe you could be just taking a bite of a donut, and I'll be pulling it out of your mouth. And he goes, that's great. That's a great idea. So I don't think Dylan really knew my ulterior motive, but he saved my butt. And the coolest thing about it is it's all there on tape for you to see. If you ever see that first episode of The Practice, you can see the first shot is me stuffing a donut into Dylan McDermott's mouth. And it's a victory. It's a huge victory,
Did you have to coach them in other, because I'm talking to you, I can say this, fat girl props? Did they come up with other things like that?
Oh, yeah. It's so funny, the stereotype. I'm like the fat police now. I have a badge. I whip it out. If you make a mistake, I'm like, hey, fat police, you can't do that. I got to the set. There was a candy bowl on my desk. I went, are you crazy? You put candy on the fat girl's desk? I'm going to tell you a little secret. Fat girls don't keep the candy on the desk. They keep it in the drawer. And I said, if you really want, me to have a relationship with the candy, put the candy on the skinny girl's desk and I'll look at it every time I walk by. But it's like I had to educate them. It was, it's very interesting. And I still have to educate people.
You made a big impression with your This Is For All the Fat Girls acceptance speech at the Emmys. Had you come up with that line a decade ago? Something you always rehearsed in your head? If I win the Nobel Peace Prize, that's what I'm going to say.
That's a really good question. I had come up with it that day when I was in hair and makeup. Because I was nominated, they, as a treat, give you somebody to do your hair and makeup, which is, very nice. And everyone's sitting around, and everyone was jabbing me, going, what are you going to say if you win? And I'm like, shut up, I'm not going to win. And then I thought, the votes are in. It's okay if I have a speech just in case. Because to tell you the truth, a few months ago, I had been at the Tonys, and Rosie had been hosting them. And she gave everybody a lecture before the Tonys started. And she said, listen, you guys are from the theater. I don't want to see anybody reading papers. I want you to know who you're going to thank. Don't stumble. Be professional. It is such a drag when you come up here and you don't know what you're saying. Nobody likes it, and it's unflattering. I thought, ooh, okay. I totally heeded her warning, and I thought, at least I'll know who I want to say thank you to, so I don't have to take out a $3,000 ad in Variety the next day just to, make good with all those people. So I was just kind of going over it, and then I said, I'm thinking about, thanking all my fat sisters. And, everyone kind of looked at me like I was out of my mind. And I said, and my big fear is that it will be like, the Sally Fields, you like me, you really like me. And I didn't want that to happen. So I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to feel the room. I've been on the stage all my life. I've spent the last, 15 years devoted to the theater. I know when the audience is with me and when they're not. And, I can end the speech with, I just want everyone to sign my autograph book and I'll go out on a really fun thing. Or if I feel like I feel like they're with me, I'll dedicate this to my girls. So all those 15 years I had spent on the theater paid off, because when I walked up those stairs and turned around and saw the balcony and that sea of people, and I just felt the global warming in that room. I really felt it. I knew that I had permission to say it and that it was the right time to do so. And let me tell you, it has changed my life, you know, that I took the risk and said it.
Does an award like an Emmy also change your personal life?
I wish, honey. Let me tell you. I wish. You know, you think, oh, the Emmy changes your life. Well, I had a dentist appointment the very next day, and when I went in, I brought my Emmy. I said, look, I have an Emmy now. This can't hurt. And you know what? It did. It's not like I could walk around with it and go, I have an Emmy. Kiss me. But I am going to my 20th year high school reunion in July.
With the Emmy.
Do you think it'd be tacky if I bring the Emmy?
Go ahead, girl. Cameron Manheim, thanks so much for doing the interview. It was really a pleasure
Absolutely.
To talk to you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I love your show.
Cameron Manheim plays Eleanor in the legal drama The Practice on ABC.